This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
This is your current affairs program, The Rainbow Report, on Joy 94.9.
Good evening, this is Doug Pollard with another magazine of news and current affairs. Well, we've a real pick and mix program tonight with politics, sport, sex work and celebrations. For the politics, we've got Rodney Croom. There's a standoff between the government and coalition over interdependent non-conjugal couples, try saying that after a beer or two, that threatens to derail the bill to equalise the treatment of same-sex couples. On the sex work front, we have Janelle Fawkes, CEO of the sex workers' union, the Scarlet Alliance, on why she thinks sex workers with HIV should be allowed to keep working. I wonder if you agree. On sport, we have Lorraine Little, co-president of Melbourne Outgames, which is in the happy position of having some money in the bank that they've decided to give away. And as far as celebrations are concerned, we have Adam Lowe, the general manager of Midsummer Festival, here with us in the studio. And for everything else, returning to the show after an extended break, we've got Pete Dillon.
Good evening.
I gather you've been moving house.
A small move, but yes, I have a new abode.
Thank God for that. And our old friend, editor of MCV, Richard Watts.
Good evening. Lovely to be here, gentlemen. Hello.
Old friend, I should say. Old.
As in of long standing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't be such a queen. And we begin tonight with one of our trips across Bass Strait to Tasmania to talk with Rodney Croom, who joins us now on the line. Good evening, Rodney.
I'm fine. Thanks, Doug. Hi, everyone.
Okay. Now, we gather that things have gone a bit belly up in Parliament over these 100 laws, the coalitions being a bit difficult. What's happening there, Rodney?
That's right, Doug. The coalition is insisting that the government needs to recognise interdependent relationships, that's companions and siblings, at the same time as it recognises same-sex couples. The government is saying it just really doesn't want to do that. And so the two major parties are heading for a face-off in the Senate, where, of course, the balance is held by the Greens and by the Independents. Such as Senator Steve Fielding, who is likely on this issue at least to support the government, support the opposition.
Yeah.
And so that will make it very difficult for the government to get through its legislation recognising same-sex couples.
So does that mean this is going to fall over after all this hassle we've had so far?
Obviously, it would be an immense tragedy if it did, but my intuition is that it probably won't, that there'll be jockeying and positioning to try and make sure that it gets through in some form or another. One possibility, of course, is that the moderates in the coalition will force a conscience vote so that they'll have an opportunity to vote with the government, and that in return there'll be a commitment from all parties to have a kind of inquiry in the future into the recognition of interdependent relationships.
Okay.
There's a number of ways that we can get round this impasse. I think that it's probably not that likely. It's possible, but not that likely that it will fall over, like you say, but still there's going to be a lot of argy-bargy.
Okay, Pete Dillon, you want to come in here?
Rodney, how are you? I guess you've just probably answered my question, but I just wanted to ask, where are the Petro Georgios? Where are those people that do sit as small L Liberals that have supported these moves in the past to support same-sex couples in some senses? Are they likely to cross and make sure that this legislation does get through?
The sense I have is that the moderates you're talking about, like Petro Georgiou in Melbourne and others, well, they're pretty committed to this legislation, and they're increasingly stroppy with the far-right wing of their party for bringing up this kind of cycle of objection where one minute it's interdependence, the next minute it's they're concerned about polygamy, and then they're often concerned about same-sex couples with children. And there's all these various concerns, including the one we just mentioned, interdependency. I think they're getting a bit tired of that. And when it comes to the crunch, yes, I'm hopeful that they'll force some kind of conscience vote or at least moderate the coalition's position so that it accepts, like I said, an inquiry into the future, into these issues. But they need to hear from us. They won't take any action on this, or they'll be less likely to take action on this, if they don't hear concern from the LGBT community. And yet what this comes back to, I think, is us not assuming that this legislation is a foregone conclusion. We can't sit back and think, oh, the government will do what it needs to do. The Senate is still a very tricky, unpredictable place, and we need to be raising our voice as loudly as possible. In that regard, at the moment, there's a Senate inquiry into the government legislation, and I'd urge everyone concerned about this to write in saying they support it, they want it to go through as quickly as possible.
Okay, Richard Watts.
Rodney, from what you're saying, you use the phrase that you're hopeful that moderates in the government will push a conscience vote. Saying hopeful doesn't exactly sound like you're positive.
Well, I guess if I have any reservations, it's only because I saw the people we're talking about done over by the far right of the Liberal Party under the Howard government. I mean, Warren Entsch is the perfect example. He was a strong champion of same-sex, the rights of same-sex couples and removing discrimination. He worked within the party really intelligently. He did everything that the leadership told him to do, and still nothing happened. And he left Parliament without any action. And that's because they let him a merry dance right down the garden path. I don't want to see that happen again, but I fear that it might, unless, like I said, we raise our voices and we remind those moderates that they can't take anything for granted. They have to take action.
Now, the leadership of the party is different now, though. So, post-Howard, how much really, though, have things changed?
Well, that's the question. I mean, we do have a different leader now. And as we know, Brendan Nelson has a deceased brother who was a gay man and who he was very attached to. But I'm not sure if those considerations really matter that much compared to the power, the influence and the sheer manipulativeness of the anti-gay right in the Liberal Party, which is determined to block this legislation for as long as it possibly can. They are exercising all the influence they can, both on the leader and on the moderates, to slow down this process. I mean, George Brandis is another one. He's a shadow attorney general responsible for this legislation. He's quite a moderate man, a sensible man. But again, I feel that unless he's given a bit of backbone by us, then it's not necessarily the case that he'll stand up to these people. It's not necessarily the case that the Liberals will have a conscience vote to allow this through.
Rodney, will a change of leadership in the party, which is being flagged, is potentially going to happen now that Peter Costello has announced today that he's stepping back to sit on the back bench and potentially Malcolm Turnbull now has open slather to mount a challenge? Will that make a difference with a leadership change?
I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but I've always maintained that that really the leader isn't the issue here. That it's dynamics within the Liberal Party itself, where you have a very strong and well-placed anti-gay caucus, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
It's keeping its head low at the moment. It's, like I said, not saying it objects to this legislation as such. It's simply putting up these minor and often misconceived objections in order to slow things down. So it's keeping a low profile, but it's still there. And I think regardless of who the leader is, that leader would owe that group within the Liberal Party caucus, which is quite large. They're the issue for us, I think, at the moment, and we need to be giving the moderates a sense that they have to stand up to these people.
Okay, Rodney, how do we do that? I mean, who do we write to? Where do we write? Who do we call? What's the avenue here? You mentioned this Senate inquiry. Can you make a submission towards that still, and can you do that online, for example?
Yes, you can. If you just go to the Australian Parliament House website, it's pretty clear how you get to that page, and you can make a submission saying that this reform is urgent. And, I think that's really important. People often go, well, what's the point of this? I mean, the party positions are set. They're not set. It is possible for us to have an influence through things like that committee by showing that we're concerned about this. At the moment, the sense I get in Parliament House is that they think that we think this is a done deal and so, that we're just sitting back and waiting for it to happen. We shouldn't give that impression.
So who's our new Warren Entsch in the Liberal Party? If we want to start lobbying effectively, who is the new Warren Entsch that is going to take up this cause?
I'm not sure that we have a new Warren Entsch at the moment, but I'd identify, particularly in Victoria, because that's our audience at the moment. We've already identified Petro Giorgio. I mean, he's important. Greg Hunt is another one. If anyone's listening to this and they live in the electorate of Greg Hunt, write to him. He has been, in my experience, a very strong supporter of legal equality for same-sex couples for many years. And he's someone who's had a rising star in the Liberal Party, who's taken very seriously. He has a senior position. He's someone who could become a very strong advocate. So if you live anywhere near his electorate, which I think is in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne,
it's
right
in the Far East,
Hunt.
Down towards San Remo and Phillip Island area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right to Greg Hunt. He's someone who, at least in cabinet, can be a really strong advocate for us.
Mm. And even if your local MP isn't particularly, you know, if you are in the Liberal constituency and your local MP is not particularly pro-gay, you could still write to them and make the point that they do have gay constituents.
Well, Higgins is probably a good option with Peter Costello still sitting in there. I mean, Peter is not anti-gay.
And he's got nothing to lose. If he's not going for the leadership, absolutely, he's going to sit there till retirement or whenever.
Yep, very good point, yeah.
Why not give Mr. Costello a go?
And also, letters to the paper, to your, whether it be your weekly community leader newspaper, whether it be The Age or The Herald Sun, putting these views out in public to remind people of the importance of the issue for us as a community, as well as your heterosexual friends and family, asking them to lobby on our behalf as well, cannot be underestimated, because that way we can double, triple our numbers.
Yeah, because don't forget, MPs read newspapers religiously, if only to try and get a view of their own name.
Especially the Herald Sun.
Especially the Herald Sun. I think it's very important to get the Herald
Letters
Sun.
Letters to the Herald Sun, very important.
Yes. Okay, Rodney, we're going to have to leave it there and move on. Thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
That was Rodney Croom there from Tasmanian Gay and Lesbian Rights Group. Strangely enough, in Tasmania. You're listening to The Rainbow Report with me, Doug Pollard.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station.
Informing, entertaining and provoking, this is The Rainbow Report.
And I'm your host, Doug Pollard. With me in the studio, Pete Dillon, Richard Watts and Adam Lowe from Midsummer. Well, sounds like we really need to get on with the bloody campaigning again.
It does.
Isn't
it does.
A nuisance?
I think it's that this just reinforces the classic point of view that we cannot be complacent when equal rights are on the agenda. We know that conservative forces in politics and elsewhere will be very active, and certainly are very active in their letter writing campaigns. We need to do the same. It's time and time again, we hear that 5,000 letters from, for example, the various Christian lobbies will be submitted, and our community and our supporters submit 10% of that. So we have to reinforce that people really do need to be proactive.
Yeah, I was told recently by someone who's actually on the staff of a federal minister that even as few as 100 letters, and a minister will sit up and take notice.
And I'm sure that organisations like the VGLRL or the Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby New South Wales, any of those state-based lobbying organisations would be happy to assist in a form letter so that you don't have to think too hard. You just simply need to put your name on it. And and the biggest thing with all of these things is to be able to tell a personal story. This is how this affects my life. And that just carries so much weight.
Yes, yes. Don't just boilerplate something you've got some somewhere else.
A good example of those form letters can be found on the Rainbow Families Coalition's website, given that some of the lobbying they've been doing lately, and can be easily adapted.
Okay, so, you know, get on your emails, get on the Senate website.
Get the pen and paper out.
Get the pen and paper out.
Send a letter in the post.
Buy a stamp, you know, buy a stamp. Get your quill out and dip it in the inkwell.
If you are buying a stamp, please do ask for a Matthew Mitchum stamp.
Oh,
yes,
God.
Please do.
Richard Watts, you ought to be shot.
Yes, well, while we're on the subject of sports, one of the most successful gay events this year was the first Asia Pacific Out Games here in Melbourne, and of course its Associated Human Rights Conference, Rainbow Conversations. So successful, in fact, they seem to have made some money. That's very strange for a gay event, and we must ask them how they managed that, mustn't we, Adam?
Yes.
He takes some pointers. Anyway, this money they're now planning to give away. Now, one of the architects of this successful event was Lorraine Little, co-president of the Melbourne Out Games, and she joins us on the line now. Good evening, Lorraine.
Hello, Doug.
So you've got some money to give away.
I know. How fabulous is that?
That must be a first.
Well, it's not quite a first. I mean, Chill Out did very well this year as well.
Yeah, we didn't do so bad.
Yeah, no, you raised some great money for the partnership you did and the Alana Foundation, and, you know, so it's not unprecedented, but it's just great that we can start to build a chain of successful events, I think, to give our corporate sponsors and government great faith that we can run events well and, you know, financially well.
Lorraine, Richard Watts here.
Hello, Richard, and hello, Pete.
Hello, Lorraine, you gorgeous thing.
Oh, me and the boys again.
Now, in terms of building success, now that the Outgames here in Melbourne have been successful, you are building on that success by providing opportunities for other organisations to apply for funding from the Outgames.
Yes.
Now, that funding is obviously focused on growing and developing not just sport, but opportunities for sports development in the GLBT community. Is that right?
It is. That's right in part, but it is absolutely also equally about culture and human rights organisations as well, because they're the three pillars of the Outgames model. And so we're looking for applications that cover off against those things. It doesn't have to be all, you know, all three things. It could be a sporting group or club. It could be a human rights organisation, a community organisation that engages with GLBT community that is looking at developing, you know, our community. The objectives are very broad. But also the assessment panel will be considering wanting to, you know, or hopefully wanting to get a good cover across those three areas, sport, culture, human rights, mm-hmm. but also distribution across the Asia-Pacific region. So we're really looking for, hoping to get applications across the Tasman and a bit up north and so forth.
Lorraine, how big is this bucket of money? How much have you got?
The Legacy Fund is of $30,000 in total.
Good Lord, that's a good result.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, it reflects the fact that it was very, very professionally run by volunteers with great community support and also, in the end, very solid government and corporate support. And it really reflects those partnerships and really strong support from the community. So that's why it's, you know, fantastic to be in the position to be able to give back to the community. But it is a one-off fund, it's not perpetual, so, you know, this is it. There are going to be 10 grants of $1,000 and 4 grants of $5,000.
Well, I think I've got someone here who wants to apply for some of that money. I've got the general manager of Midsummer here.
I'm jumping up and down waiting to get in. Hi, Lorraine, how are you?
Well, thank you, my darling.
Yeah, no, Midsummer's certainly 100% behind getting involved in this and applying for one of the $5,000 bursaries. And we've been discussing it from three points of view. Certainly we undertook to carry forward the human rights element of the Outgames. And we're not certain whether we can do it in 2009, but We're hoping to be able to continue that conference or that interaction on the topic of human rights by engaging with Vijay LRL. You know, Hayley, I'm hoping to talk to her again soon. But the other two points that we're keen to explore in trying to find a way to apply for the money is developing more economic data around the community and how our events need, you know, through various experience of mine and others, we need more substantiated sort of data around what we can and can't offer the broader community.
I think, again, that's another element of a great outcome and a great legacy that the board have really pushed for with Outgames is that we've now got documentation, both as a summary evaluation report and a much fuller tome of information about the processes and the timelines, and we've got figures and so forth, which was very difficult for us to approach government without.
Yeah.
So we're starting to build that, and that will also build on as a legacy for the second Asia-Pacific Outgames. That's going to feed into that.
Well, I would hope it would allow Midsummer to exercise perhaps a bit more muscle and find more money from its funding sources. Mm. You know, the funding sources for Midsummer are quite limited, and probably
absolutely.
Surprisingly so, if you
Richard.
Look at it.
Lorraine, a two-part question for you, I guess.
Yep.
One is that how is it that the Asia-Pacific Outgames managed to make a profit, whereas the first World Outgames made a significant loss? And also, how is it that you think that the Asia-Pacific Outgames made a loss at a time when other community at a time when other community organisations, such as the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby and the Also Foundation, were actually having to cancel fundraising events because of a lack of support?
The latter part in terms of other community events was actually well discussed in a Joy program, and I think that was a matter of just oversupply of events and fickle planning, or not planning, but decision-making on our punters' behalf. It's really difficult to get people to commit early.
I think you mentioned that, Adam, didn't you?
Yeah, yes. And I think you know, nobody sells tickets very far in advance anymore. You have to be kind of known to sell tickets in advance.
Enough of this blatant promotion over there in the corner. Thank you, Doug Pollard.
Yeah, and so to go back to the main crux of the question, I think the comparison between a World Out Games and a regional games is clearly scale. And perhaps there were elements about the model that we developed, which was about partnering with existing events and community organisations that could help deliver rather than trying to create everything new. Was really successful, and it enhanced both elements. So I know for Pride March, it was great for us to have that as a closing celebration.
Yeah.
But it certainly enhanced the profile and the participation rates, and the whole just atmosphere of Pride was sensational.
I think that's one of the great things that we got out of Out Games generally, that we've got to work together on these things. We can't have all these different things happening in isolation.
We've all
got to sort of share resources, share infrastructure and logistics
knowledge.
And knowledge and everything
which
I know Midsummer is working on doing.
Yeah.
Pete, you wanted to come in here.
Yeah, look, I'm just sort of perhaps wanting to paraphrase all of what's been said. And so the three areas, obviously the sporting, the cultural, human rights events, organisations are those that can apply.
Mm-hmm.
And this is to increase participation profile and organisational capacity. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, yeah.
How do people go about doing that?
They just need to go to the Melbourne Out Games website, which is melbourneoutgames.org, and click on the Legacy Fund link. Then it's got quite comprehensive guidelines that need to be read before one contemplates filling in the application form. Applicants need to be members of GLESA Asia Pacific. Now, that's really easy because the membership form is online as well. It's free to become a member, and simply, what is the...
Just for those who don't know, what's GLESA?
Oh, my apologies. GLESA is the Gay and Lesbian International Sporting Association of Asia Pacific.
Thank you.
And they are the ongoing entity that will be continuing on the work of what we've started here in Melbourne. Melbourne Out Games Inc. and myself and Peter will, I promise you all, disappear off the radar by the end of the year. We're winding up, and that was always planned. We were formed to run the Out Games, but we obviously want the legacy to continue through QSAM, Queer Sports Alliance Melbourne, in Melbourne, and the GLESA Asia Pacific.
Richard, you wanted to come in here with a quick
Lorraine, given
question.
That
we're going to have to wind
was
this up
the
soon.
Asia Pacific Out Games, how will you be letting GLBT organisations throughout the Asia-Pacific region, particularly in developing nations, how will you let them know that this fund exists and that they can apply for it?
Okay, there's several strategies to our marketing pitch here. We've obviously sent out an e-bulletin to all of the existing registrants who attended the Out Games here earlier the year, particularly using the networks of the conference committee to send it out, talking to us and getting it out in the media as much as possible, but it's predominantly a viral campaign in a way.
Yeah, well, that worked when you were setting the thing up, so it should work pretty well. And you had a series of champions, I think,
we had champions, and we've also got the GLESA Asia Pacific Board.
So you've got lots of contacts there.
Yeah.
Look, we're going to have to wind this up, Lorraine, but before you go... what's happening with Copenhagen? The city weren't going to pay for us to do our Melbourne bit in Copenhagen. What's happening now?
Well, the great news is that City of Melbourne, and this is referring to the major cultural component of the World Out Games
next
cities. Year.
Yep.
It's called Out Cities. It's a city-to-city invitation. So City of Melbourne, first of all, were a bit unsure about it or unable to commit, and then... like Phoenix Rising, we are back. And it got the seed funding approval from the full council, and that allowed us to put on a producer, creative producer, who is now in the midst of drawing up a draft program and putting in funding submissions to the various and the obvious bodies, because it's a much bigger project budget than what we received from council. Council gave what we applied for, or not what we applied, what we asked for, because it's actually a City of Melbourne event. So it's really exciting. I mean, Amsterdam is there, Mexico, Rio de Janeiro, Tel Aviv.
And Melbourne be right there alongside them.
Yeah, and we've got a bit of a theme going called Out of the Square.
Right.
Because Melbourne always likes, you know, we like to think out of the square.
Well, we always like to be in squares, Federation Square, City Square.
We'll be in a square in Copenhagen, but we are out of the square as well in our thinking.
Okay. Just a quick couple of SMSs here I'd like to throw to you before we go. Why not pass the legacy funds to support the next Asia Pacific Art Games, asked Simon from Caulfield.
The next Asia Pacific Art Games has been allocated an amount of money from us towards the running of the next games, and
so
there's
this
a lot of knowledge transfer
left over
as well.
Okay, and the other question is, would a religious organisation outreaching to the gay community be eligible?
They need to have a look at the guidelines, as I said. All of the eligibility criteria are in there, and as I said, the bottom line is they need to be a member of GLESA Asia Pacific. So it's about an organisation which operates within synergy of the same goals and objectives.
Okay.
So I'm guessing that the the Phillip Island Adventure Association, for example, who turned away the Way Out Youth Group, probably won't be eligible to
let's
apply.
Not,
correct.
Let's not go there.
The last thing about the fund is that people need to know that 12th of October is the deadline for application. So it's a pretty small window.
Pretty tight deadline, yeah.
Yep. It's not a very onerous process of application.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, Lorraine. Awful lot of stuff to get in a very short time. Sorry to rush you, but...
That's all right. I've got to rush off to volleyball now.
She's going spiking again.
It was a sporty thing. Again. All right. Thank you, Lorraine.
Good night, boys.
See you, love.
Good night.
That was Lorraine Little there, the co-president of Melbourne Art Games, with some good news.
It's so nice to talk good news for a change,
isn't it? I mean, we're so often doom and gloom, unfortunately.
Well, it's a pessimistic world we live in, I guess, in some of the results that we get. But that's just a cracking result from. I know how hard those people work to make that event so successful.
And I find that very encouraging when she says there at the end, you know, you say, where's the money and all the other stuff, and she says that, we've already given some money to the next Asia Pacific Art Games. This 30,000 is what we got left over.
Do we know where it is, the next Asia Pacific Art Games?
I don't think we do at this point. Anyway, you're listening to The Rainbow Report.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au.
Keeping the GLBTI community up to date, this is The Rainbow Report.
Yes, and this is me, Doug Pollard, bringing it to you with the help of Pete Dillon, Richard Watts and Adam Lowe. Well, you may or may not have seen a little while ago, there was a case of a sex worker in Canberra. And there were some very sensationalist headlines. HIV sex worker may have infected 250 and so on and so forth. Now, on the line now, we have someone who knows all about this case, Janelle Fawkes, who's the CEO of, what do you call yourselves, the Scarlet Alliance?
That's right. Scarlet Alliance is the Australian Sex Workers Association.
Yeah, your trade union, in other words.
Yeah.
Now, tell us a bit about this case.
Sure. It is, as you say, a case of that has been covered by a lot of sensationalist media. Mm-hmm. It was, in fact, a HIV-positive sex worker operating as a sex worker in the ACT. But unfortunately, under the ACT prostitution regulations, it's illegal to be a sex worker, and whilst you have HIV.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, the name of the section of that piece of legislation is knowingly infecting.
Right.
Even though the charge itself refers to the act of being a sex worker whilst you have a STI, not that there is any implication that any transmission has occurred.
Okay, now, a lot of people might think it was sensible that people with HIV shouldn't be working in the sex industry, so why don't you take that line?
Well, I think if you take that approach, then you would have to believe that HIV-positive people don't have the right to have sex because sex work settings in Australia are well known for having high levels of condom use. Sex workers are well documented as being very successful at implementing safe sex practices and negotiating that with their clients. And that's proven by the epidemiology in Australia that shows very low rates of STIs and HIV amongst sex workers.
Okay, Pete Dillon, you wanted to come in.
Sorry, Janelle, I just want to pull you up there. You're saying that, and I need you to clarify this because I may have misunderstood, you're saying that HIV people essentially can't have sex because of this legislation. Aren't you specifically talking about HIV-infected sex workers not being able to perform their role, therefore that denies them having sex? I think that's a bit cloudy.
Right, no. What I was saying was, as your colleague put forward, the idea that some people would believe that sex workers with HIV shouldn't have the right to be sex workers. And what I was saying was, if you believe that, then you're basically saying the next step from that is that you must believe that generally people who are HIV positive shouldn't have the right to have sex.
Sorry, I think that's drawing a very long bow.
Well, I don't think so at all, because the fact is, in a sex work setting, there are higher rates of condom use than in a general sexual interaction. So actually, we see, and the epidemiology shows, that in fact sex in a sex work setting is often safer sex.
Now, I'm glad you used that phrase, safer sex, because there is still a risk, even if one practices what is known as safe sex, because there is, in fact, no 100% safe sex, is
there? Abstinence, Doug, abstinence.
Well, besides abstinence. I mean, if one's going to have sex, yeah, one can practice safer sex, but there is always, however small, a risk, is there not?
Well, you know, the fact is that in Australia we have a sex industry of around 20,000 sex workers at any one time, mm-hmm. having sex,
fairly frequently.
A few times a day, fairly frequently. And we have a lot of clients out there visiting a whole range of sex workers. But actually, condom use is extremely high. So is the implementation of a range of other safe sex practices. So I think it does show that when safer sex practices are implemented successfully and by people who are experienced and educated on how to do that, in fact, the risk is very low.
Okay. Now, we're talking here about what you described, I think, as sex work settings. That is, I assume you're talking about places like brothels and so on.
Right.
Rather than what I might call the casual trade, the street trade.
Well, actually, no, I wasn't differentiating because, in fact, in Australia we have very high rates of condom use and safer sex implementation across the industry generally. So, I'm talking about the sex industry generally.
Is that across a regulated industry?
No, it's not just across the regulated industry. I think you have a real problem in Victoria in the way that your legislation, which is basically a licensing framework, has divided the industry into, if you like, a two-tiered industry, where people see it as the regulated and the unregulated industry. In fact, we are not seeing that there is lesser safe sex happening within sex industry premises that are not licensed, and we certainly don't hear that amongst sex workers that there is less safe sex occurring within places that are not licensed. I think it's a little bit pushed actually by some of the legal brothel owners who, as you may know, are running a campaign in Victoria pushing for greater regulation of people who are or operations that aren't licensed. I think we should be very aware not to fall into that trap.
Well, that's a very interesting discussion. I've just got an SMS in here from one of our listeners. I'm sure there are people out there who use sex workers who are themselves HIV positive, and they wouldn't mind having sex with someone with the same status, a niche market for you, says this listener.
That's right. And look, in fact, HIV positive sex workers, Scarlet Alliance has just done a 12-month needs assessment of HIV positive sex workers in Australia. It's only the second to ever happen in Australia, and both of those have been done by Scarlet Alliance. And by far what we are finding is stigma and discrimination are serious impacts on the lives of HIV positive people. But very clearly, HIV positive sex workers who experience that same stigma and discrimination are still implementing safe sex practices with their clients very successfully. Yes, many of them, their clients are HIV positive people as well, but I think it's important for us to point out that when safer sex does take place in a sexual interaction, there is actually very low risk of transmission.
Yep.
That is proven in Australia. So I think we need to keep that in mind. In fact, we're not talking about when HIV positive people have sex, but actually it's there is a huge risk. When safer sex practices are used, the risk is actually negligible.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time tonight, Janelle. We're going to have to leave it there because we're running a bit low on time. And, you know, the best of luck with your campaign.
Thank you very much.
That was Janelle Fawkes, CEO of the Scarlet Alliance. That's the Australian Sex Workers Association. Well, an interesting thing, a bit difficult one there. HIV positive sex workers. I'd never given that any thought, to be honest.
One of the issues I think at play here is that if you are denying somebody the right to practice their lawful trade on the basis of their HIV status, you're discriminating against somebody.
Yes, and that's not legal. No. Very, bit of a minefield.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. If you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Before we run completely out of time and give Adam a chance to talk to us tonight, last week we talked with Brett Hayhoe, who seems to have been around forever, but our next guest is somewhat of a more recent arrival on the gay festival community events scene.
Fresh meat.
Yes, fresh meat. Turned
we
up last year
meat.
Organising the Midsummer Carnival, and now, Adam, you've stepped into the general manager role. What did that feel like you were stepping
I
into?
I fell into it. It is a trial by fire for sure. Because I'm still learning about the community as much as I'm learning about the organisation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been an interesting several months so far. I've been kind of wearing the hat since March.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background in terms
where
of...
Where did you come from?
Exactly.
Okay.
I come from
a performing arts background an event management background. I toured Australia and Asia with most of the Broadway musicals that have come to this country in the last 15 years. Most recently, production stage managing producers in Melbourne at the Princess Theatre. It was the last show I did in Melbourne. But I also have, for about 13 years, had a fairly major event career in major sporting events and cultural events in opening ceremonies and so on and so forth. The first opening ceremony being about 1995 for the Global Cultural Diversity Conference, hosted by the then Prime Minister Paul Keating and the UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali, creating, with other colleagues, of course, creating the opening and closing ceremonies for that event. But it's led to I was the calling stage manager for the opening ceremony of the Sydney 2000 Olympics. And I came back to Australia at the beginning of 2007, having been in the Middle East, in Muslim Middle East for 2 years with the Asian Pacific the Asian Games, the 15th Asian Games opening and closing ceremonies, came back to Melbourne, did the FINA World Aquatic opening and closing ceremonies at Rod Laver Arena.
So Midsummer's a big change from all that. I mean, it's quite a different thing from an opening and a closing ceremony. This is a great sprawling beast of a thing.
But ultimately, at the heart of Midsummer, I think, as a point in time, is Carnival Day, which is a fairly massive event. And as you pointed out, I produced the Carnival Day for Midsummer, this 2008 festival at Alexandra Gardens. And even in the most recent funding application process with the City of Melbourne, who was Midsummer's sole largest funding stream at $70,000 per annum currently. They've moved us out of arts and culture and into major events.
Mm-hmm.
So my major events career suits much of the organisation, but the arts background suits the arts and cultural side of things. So it's about finding out how to make that work now.
Adam, one of the hats I wear, I'm the chair of the Melbourne Fringe Festival, mm-hmm. so I'm aware of the precarious balancing act between sponsors and key stakeholders and so on. One of the key stakeholders for any festival is the community itself. Yeah. How are you involving the community in Midsummer in terms of finding out what the community want from their festival? Because there has been kind of a wide... several attempts over the last few years to remake Midsummer, rebrand it in different ways.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's been successful, sometimes not.
I have three keywords at the moment. The consolidate, stabilise and relevance. They're the three keywords that I use when trying to think about how to do what. I find the organisation, although the brand strength is incredibly high, most people in the community would probably think Midsummer is very healthy, has got a lot of friends and got a lot of resource. I think it's actually completely the opposite. It's at the bottom of a sine curve of the kind of life cycle of these organisations. In the first place, my first approach to 2009 festival is to take the foot off the gas, stop and try to catch some breath, to try to work out how we could do much less whilst we take time to re-establish some business systems and some relationship issues that are really, really not solid at the moment.
But for Joe Punter, that's a whole bunch of business gobbledygook, and I don't mean to be disrespectful.
Sure.
My concern, and I would be concerned as, you know, a poor for a lesbian living in a suburb somewhere that's not actively engaged with our community in the scene, so to speak, that Midsummer for me is my Christmas. And I don't want somebody sitting back and, you know, making, you know, really relevant business decisions. I want a festival that I can engage with.
Yeah, well, in 2009... The festival will be 95% community-produced events. The only event Midsummer will produce is Carnival Day, mm-hmm. In entirety. However, we have two series, visual arts exhibition series that are curated by Midsummer volunteer working groups that are funded by the City of Melbourne and the City of Yarra. Those two exhibition series will continue. Carnival Day will be the only thing that we throw lots of money at. And we, through the success of last year's Pink Shorts short play series, that will come back this year through sponsorship at RMIT.
Mm.
They're prepared to take the risk on that effectively,
mm-hmm.
And offer us a venue at the Callide Theatre there in kind and deliver that. So without Midsummer having to spend a great deal of money on Pink Shorts will be back. The visual arts that are well funded will be back, and we'll only produce Carnival Day. The rest of it is up to the community, and the registration for CPE, the community produced events, is open now. It's open till September 22nd. midsummer.org.au. Follow the steps there. Download the PDF of instructions. To be slightly cheap, we couldn't make it a completely online process that you can save and come back to later. You have to download the PDF, make sure you've got all the information, and come back and do it in one sitting and register your event. And that's how the festival will exist in 2009. That buys me time to start to get out there. I'm trying to get out and meet as many people as I can to introduce myself slowly. That's happening. And then in 2009... What I'd like to do is start an earlier planning cycle for 2010 and engage in, like, I'd like to get all of the club and pub owners in and have a have a meeting with them. Like, one of them, give us one night in your pub, I'll come in and I'll sit there and we'll invite everybody else who owns a pub. We'll sit around and and chew the fat. We'll do that somewhere else with, community organisations. Come here to the City Village and sit upstairs with you guys and chat with all the community organisations, etc.
Okay.
etc.
Well, look, we're running a bit low on time here, Adam. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Everything's kind of run over tonight, but I did want you to get that bit in about how you apply for the events, because that time is coming up fairly soon, and so is ours. And we cannot leave today without, of course, Kay Sarah, with her own inimitable look beneath the bonnet. This week, she's casting her eye over the USA, so it's probably a poke bonnet. She's looking at some septic tanks have been making news lately. Vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin Palin and her country cousins, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Sarah Palin and I have got a lot in common. We both look great in a tailored two-piece. We're both country gals at heart. And importantly, we both love mousse. Of course, I prefer my mousse served chilled with a dollop of whipped cream and preferably chocolate, whereas Sarah isn't satisfied unless her mousse is gutted and diced and bubbling away in a three-day Alaskan stew. Fabulous as Governor Palin may be in lipstick and heels, I'm still trying to confirm the rumour that she is the love child of British PM Margaret Thatcher and President Ronald Reagan. The Iron Lady and Teflon Ron were seen smooching over a soda pop in 1964. DNA test immediately, I say. I have a lock of Baroness Thatcher's hair, a souvenir of our political battles over that dreaded Clause 28, introduced by Maggie in the 80s to stop the promotion of homosexuality. And for a DNA sample of Reagan, Fannie Mae, a dear drag friend of mine, assures me she has a stained gingham frock she swears is Ron's amorous nasty work. Dear old Fannie, times are not what they used to be. The old girl has been putting out for decades, almost single-handedly providing shelter and comfort to millions of Americans, only to find, when push comes to shove, the cupboard is bare. I blame that no-accountant husband of hers, Freddie Mac. That layabout loon was only ever after her money. And to add insult to injury, when times couldn't be more tough for dear Fannie, Uncle Sam turns up on her doorstep with a big fat check. Well, the entire US economy may be on the skids, but the last thing Americans need is another blank check signed by George Bush Jr. Hasn't the war in Iraq been enough? Besides, the land of milk and honey is supposed to be the pin-up for the free market, and a state-funded bailout of Fannie Mae is just too Cuban. But I digress. While the current US presidential campaign is none of my business, I do think Senator Obama has missed the boat. If he was serious about capturing the white female vote, he should have signed up Oprah as his running mate for the White House. The queen of TV chat has been courting middle America since landing her multidimensional behind on the proverbial sofa some 30 years back. If Sarah Palin is after makeup tits for her pit bull, and personally, I think lipstick on your family dog is just too weird, she could do a lot worse than follow Oprah's lead. Better still, take a leaf out of Clarie Belcher's book. You remember Clarie. She was the Southern Belle in the film Steel Magnolias. The only thing that separates us from the animals is our ability to accessorize, said Clarie. It's a mantra I and Fannie Mae live our life by. That and another fabulous Southern Belle line. I have always relied on the kindness of strangers. Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire. Blanche also said, I know I fib a good deal. After all, a woman's charm is 50% illusion. And I can't help but feel that's closer to Sarah Palin's worldview. I'm Kay Sarar, and I'm running for president of the Country Women's Association. I've even got the tea towel collection to prove it.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there on that note with Kay and her
stuff.
Tea towel collection. My thanks to my guests tonight, Adam Lowe from Midsummer, Richard Watts from MCV, Pete Dillon, Janelle Fawkes from the Scarlet Alliance, Lorraine Little of Melbourne Out Games, and of course, as you just heard, Kay Sarar. And not forgetting you, thanks for all your messages and calls. Don't forget, you can now access podcasts of the program at joy.org.au, as well as a blog at rainbowreporter.com. Big thanks to my producer Bianca Johnston, and technical producer tonight was Travis. Thanks, Travis, and a Rainbow Report Virgin. I'll be back next week with another edition of The Rainbow Report.
This has been a Joy 94.9 News and Current Affairs presentation.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.